Welcome back to the Green Front, where we have been reporting on the green eco-evolution, as I like to call it. It's a bit of a revolution, but more of an evolution as America and the rest of the world wakes up to smell the CO2 and all of our challenges on so many fronts. But at the same time, there are so many people doing great work, coming up with solutions and greener products and programs. And now we need to get a movement going to demand greener policies and politicians, and we think we got a pretty green president, but there's some people who think President Obama has not been tough enough with the oil spill, with supporting climate change legislation, but we'll give him, I'm willing to give him a chance. Let's see what happens with this current legislation, which was unveiled last week, actually, during our program, during the Green Front. So now that a lot of the environmental groups have had a chance to sift through the almost 1,000-page document, I have not looked through it, but I've been really looking at a lot of the reaction to it. And it's really mixed. Usually the environmental intelligentsia, the green groups, the large NGOs like the Sierra Club, the NRDC, Environmental Defense Fund, Friends of the Earth, et cetera, usually are you know, in pretty strong agreement or disagreement on things, and especially on legislation. But this one is kind of split right down the middle. There was a statement issued a couple of days ago by a coalition of some of the smaller green groups saying that this is nothing more than a taxpayer bailout of the nuclear power industry and other dirty energy interests, and they're saying this is not going to be effective in addressing the climate crisis. And, of course, we're talking about the Kerry-Lieberman bill, otherwise known as the American Power Act. At the same time, a lot of the larger groups like the Sierra Club, I had a chance to chat with Michael Bruin, the head of that group, last night at a Commonwealth Club event. He was on an energy panel, and I asked him what he thought, and he said, well, it's a start. It's, you know, a step in the right direction. And that seems to be, you know, the position of most of the mainstream environmental organizations, saying let's hail this as something we've been waiting for. It is something we've needed for a long time, and let's work to make it stronger. So with some perspective on that, maybe from right in the middle of the green spectrum, is Environmental Defense Fund, and pleased to welcome Wade Crowfoot to the Green Front. And Wade is the West Coast Political Director for EDF. Thanks for joining us, Wade.
Thanks for having me, Betsy.
And tell us what you think. You, I assume, representing the EDF. And if you can, just between us green friends, you know, a little bit, you know, of thinking behind whatever EDF's position is, since there has been some divergent point of view on the strengths, the drawbacks of this legislation, and how much can it be worked on and changed? I mean, I thought legislation, when it, you know, is introduced, yes, it goes through some machinations and deliberations, but if it's going to see the light of day soon enough to make a difference, you know, how much can it go from what it is now to something that is almost unrecognizable, because some environmental proponents feel that that's necessary to call this a good climate bill?
Yeah, well, there's certainly a lot that can change from what's been introduced to what would actually get passed by the Senate. And so even though they're talking about a very short time frame of, you know, 60 to 120 days to see if this can be passed, certainly a lot can change. And we would agree that this is very much the start of the conversation. But EDF would also agree with the Sierra Club and NRDC and other groups that this is a very big step forward. So the proposal that Senators Kerry and Lieberman introduced last week, for the first time in American history, actually creates a declining limit on greenhouse gas pollution in our country. And that's critical. Well, I should say, too, that and that limit is actually the percentage limits that President Obama talked about in Copenhagen, and what a lot of people think the rest of the world needs to see to consider that America is taking active leadership on this issue. 17% reduction by 2020 in greenhouse gas pollution, and then ultimately 80% reduction by 2050, which is widely identified as essentially sort of the number that we need to get to achieve planetary balance. So
now, will that get us down to 350 parts per million, which is, of course,
Bill
McKibben's intention?
I believe
okay.
So, and that's been the goal, and certainly a stretch goal, but one that we're very happy is in this legislation. And so, first and foremost, that is the most important part, we believe, of any clean energy and climate legislation. There are certainly ways that this bill could be strengthened, and EDF and other green groups are working on that. But we're also recognize that the authors are working to achieve balance among the different geographic interests that are represented by the senators in order to get 60 votes. So I would say that, you know, on this, while, you know, certainly our environmental colleagues who have been critical of elements of this bill certainly have a lot of valid points, we think that we need to start now, and the urgency of now in the urgency of this issue is such that we actually need to move forward and not necessarily make the perfect the enemy of the good on this.
And the House bill was quite a bit stronger, the one that was initially passed last June, almost a year ago. Can they be reconciled given that the Senate bill is, in some people's view, much weaker?
Well, it's a great question. As most listeners know, the process is that bills have to be passed in both houses, the House of Representatives and the Senate. And if they differ, there needs to be what's called a reconciliation process. Where the both houses agree on changes. And that question remains to be seen, Betsy. I mean, I think the first significant hurdle is achieving this 60-vote majority in the Senate. And we certainly believe that there's strong momentum to do that. But, you know, to be truthful, it's definitely uncertain whether Senators Kerry and Lieberman can actually get those votes that they need in this session.
Especially with Lindsey Graham pulling out and with the traded votes that was going to happen, you know, we'll give you some offshore oil drilling benefits if you vote for climate change legislation, since offshore oil drilling is going to be front and center, you know, under scrutiny, and no one's going to be talking for a while about building any new rigs, most likely. Is that, you know, opportunity to trade those votes off the table, and then is it even going to be harder to get 60 votes? I think that's some of the concern.
It's a fascinating conversation because, you know, their senators represent states with very different portfolios of energy. For example, the state of Indiana that has two senators who are, I believe, considered fence sitters is overwhelmingly a state that depends on coal-based energy. And so, of course, the senators from Indiana are concerned about what would there be cost impacts on coal, and is there funding to try to make coal less polluting? While you have senators from other states that are focused on offshore drilling, as you just mentioned, like Lindsey Graham and others, I think that the real test of this bill is really twofold. One, as I said, is does it create this declining limit on greenhouse gas pollution? Ultimately, if we're going to address climate change, that's what needs to occur. Not only in the country, but again, international action hinges on our national leadership. And then the second test is, does this move us towards a clean energy future? I don't think any environmentalists are, or many environmentalists anyways, are thrilled with certain provisions in the bill that would provide resources to traditional forms of energy, fossil fuel-based forms of energy. But we recognize the reality on the ground in the United States, and that is that a lot of the country gets primarily their energy from coal and oil and other fossil fuel forms of energy. So that's not going to change tomorrow. So I think the test is, does this bill actually move us aggressively towards a great increase in solar energy, wind energy, geothermal, ocean-based renewable energy, while at the same time try to aggressively clean up these forms of fossil fuel energy that are going to be with us in the near future?
Recent polls show that about 60% of U.S. citizens polled said that they do want to see America move toward a clean energy economy and begin to really seriously address the climate threat. Do you think this splitting down the middle, if that's accurate, of the environmental group's position on the climate bill will be a hindrance towards that? Or is it okay that there's some divergent opinion among respected, you know, substantially sized environmental organizations that cover these issues and work on policy, you know, 24/7?
Yeah, well, I think it's inevitable that there's going to be some difference of opinion on legislation as complex as this. As you said, 987-page bill, which I have to concede I haven't read all the way through either, Betsy. But there's also, of course, withering criticism of this bill on the other side of the spectrum, which is oil-based interests and coal-based interests that are working to kill this legislation. And so, you know, while, you know, all groups in the environmental community play a role, and it's probably, you know, helpful that there are groups that are really pushing the envelope to make this bill as strong as it can be. And as I said, even those groups like ours that are supportive of the effort are working to make it stronger. But I think as you reference the poll numbers, and they're encouraging poll numbers, because I think Americans understand at least a couple things very clearly. One is that we need to become energy independent as a country. Every day, believe it or not, $1 billion leaves America to buy oil in different parts of the world. Many of the places that we're buying oil, as it's talked about, fund dictatorships that are repressive to minority ethnic groups, to women's rights, etc. These are bad players who we're basically subsidizing. For example, Iran makes, I believe, $100 million every day off the U.S. consumption of oil. So American energy independence is one thing that people across the political spectrum agree with and understand. The other point is jobs, that, you know, the world is not waiting to actually create cleaner forms of energy. I think it was this year China's monthly investment in clean technology just surpassed the United States, and that's trending upwards from China. So these are jobs that are being created, and the question is, are we going to work our way out of the economic recession with these clean energy jobs and investing in these clean energy jobs, highly paid clean energy jobs, or are we going to relinquish leadership and have those jobs be created elsewhere in the world? Now, there are a lot of us who are very concerned about climate change, but I think based on the two points I just made, energy independence and jobs, one doesn't have to be supportive of taking action on climate change. One doesn't even have to believe that climate change is existing to actually support this bill, because it does achieve that energy independence and does create jobs in our communities.
And since that is the case, it really is more practical than political, but yet it has been so politicized. And because every day there's more evidence, if anyone is, you know, half awake, of climate change arriving, you know, on our shores, and if not, you know, hitting low-lying nations and island nations, you know, the poorer parts of the world every day, you'd think it would be an easier battle, you know. And I guess it is. It's the vested interests. It's a special interest. It's politics as usual. And those who are invested in the status quo that are really standing in the way. But sometimes I have to wonder, don't they have children? Aren't they concerned about where things are headed? If we don't have a healthy and abundant and diverse, you know, ecosystems, if we don't have, you know, abundant, clean food and water supplies, what good is anything else going to be?
I completely agree with you, Betsy. I think one of the challenges with climate change is it's less visible than other forms of pollution. I mean, it's not, you know, rivers catching on fire in the 1970s or soot building up on people's homes in the 1980s and 90s. It, you know, certainly there are visible impacts of climate change. You know, I'm from Michigan, and the Great Lakes, for example, have decreased in terms of the height of the lake, so much so in the last 10 or 15 years that there are wetlands now that are growing where sand beaches were on Lake Michigan. I mean, certainly there are these physical manifestations of climate change, but I think to the average, you know, person that's, you know, getting up, going to work, coming home, raising a family, it's harder to see. So I think our main message has been, while we want to help educate people on the impacts of climate change, is not to make that the central argument, really to lead with these two very irrefutable facts, which is America should be more energy independent, and we want to create more jobs in our communities across the U.S. Those are two arguments that are very compelling, again, regardless of whether you believe in climate change or not.
And I'll throw in another one. If you happen to see the world through green colored lenses, whether you want to or not, which I do, having been born with that extra green gene, I guess, when you turn on the news in the morning and the Today Show is covering, you know, record tornadoes, 160-mile-an-hour winds hitting Yazoo City, Mississippi, when Al Gore's hometown, Nashville, is underwater, you know, record flooding, and you start connecting those dots, you know, who also wants to subject Americans or anybody on the planet to, you know, record intense storms? And while we cannot definitively say that is, you know, climate change induced or infused, if you look at, you know, collectively the sheer number of weather events that have been, you know, what some would say, global weirding, evidence of instability in our climate. You know, that these are all American patriotic folks, you know, down there saying their lives have been destroyed. Their homes were just flooded. Their homes were just, you know, blown to bits in tornadoes. I mean, there was someone on from the Mississippi tornado who lost the wife and the child were lost in the storm. I mean, that's serious impacts.
Yeah, absolutely. And we need to continue to connect the dots.
Yeah, and not that storms didn't happen before. You know, it's just that if you pay attention, there's a lot of record weather activity, and that isn't that what the beginning of climate instability might look like?
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, and that really speaks to the urgency of actually taking action now. You know, so while I respect those who say, well, this bill shouldn't be supported, you know, this is our best chance in the near future to actually get a declining limit on greenhouse gas pollution. And the world can't wait. You know, the world is watching. And so we as environmentalists and folks who are listening across the country today really need to make their voice heard and to say enough is enough. Believe it or not, it's been 40 years since the first American president started talking about, you know, energy independence and taking a lot of these actions. And a lot of people may think I'm talking about Jimmy Carter. It was actually Richard Nixon.
Right.
And so
He put that sweater on. We'll never forget that. And that focused a lot of people on their thermostats.
Yeah, great point. So, you know, I would just say that, you know, we need to look past getting a perfect bill and making sure that we get a strong bill that actually moves us towards taking action.
Don't let the Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Yeah,
that
precisely.
That comes to mind. And yeah, I mean, if this doesn't fly, what's next? People say we won't see any action for years, and we shudder to think what the world will look like a couple years down the road if we don't do anything. And, you know, other nations, especially in Europe and now China, yeah, they're really catching up, if not taking the lead, in terms of their commitment to clean technology and a green energy future. So we're not only not leading, but we're, you know, really at risk of being left behind. And what an opportunity to be, you know, creating jobs.
Absolutely. And think about healthcare. You know, when the Clinton administration almost passed healthcare reform, that was, I think, 1992, early 90s, it took over 15 years for the federal government to pursue healthcare reform again. Could you imagine if this is our opportunity to pass clean energy and climate legislation and we wait 15 more years for the federal government to take action on this and probably the world waits along with us? You know,
no, and you know what? It would be hard to... Sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I think a lot of us argue that we don't have 15 years to wait.
Right. Not to mention the fact that it will be hard at that point to track down all the people who oppose climate change legislation for whatever reason, and all the talk show hosts who are spewing hot air about how climate change is it's a hoax, you know, led by Al Gore. I'd like to, like, fast forward, you know, like freeze frame and ask them, you know, now what do you have to say? It's sort of like Sarah Palin's arrogant, you know, declarations, you know, drill, baby, drill. I think you should put on a sandwich board that, you know, says drill, baby, drill, and go down and clean up the coastline right now and rescue, you know, oil-soaked birds. You know, it's just the arrogance of some people who would oppose environmental legislation that benefits everyone, you know, clinging so tightly to the status quo, you know, follow the money, follow the oil slick, if you will. That's what bothers me, that where are those folks going to be when our children are suffering?
Absolutely. I mean, without getting too moralistic, I almost compare, you know, the analogy I draw is with the civil rights movement of the 1960s. When I was learning as a young person about the civil rights movement, you know, I thought, geez, were there actually people that were against expanding civil rights to all Americans? And, you know, believe it or not, there certainly were. And these were people that were on the wrong side of history. And I think the climate opponents and the opponents of, you know, a clean energy future, like Senator Murkowski, in the Senate right now, who's actually moving a bill that would move us backwards, are truly on the wrong side of history. And I think history will be a really harsh judge to those leaders who don't recognize the problem and aren't even working towards a solution.
Yeah, not to mention right now as we speak, those in Congress who don't want to, you know, the oil companies, you know, want to have some limit to their liability, and those who are supporting that, you know, you have to just follow the money, and it's just painfully clear that the special interests are the reason that we're not getting, legislation that would benefit the special interest, which is the public good. And just not even talking about only climate change regulations, but, you know, just pollution and asthma, which is still an epidemic in our country, and how many people, thousands of Americans die, you know, from lung ailments every year because of pollution. So, you know, whatever your position on climate change, cleaning up our environment really should be job number one, priority number one. And I'm sure you don't disagree with that, and yet it's mind-boggling sometimes when you see what we who are concerned about our environmental future have to go through just to, you know, get some really basic things implemented.
Yeah, but, you know, we're working to bring about change, we're fighting against powerful, deep-pocketed interests. If you look at the amount of money that many oil companies have spent killing federal climate legislation, you'll understand, you know, what clean energy advocates are up against. Out here in California, we've got a landmark law called AB 32, which is our own state limit on greenhouse gas emissions that we think is a very powerful complement to federal legislation. Well, guess what? Oil company named Valero and another oil company named Tesoro are coming into the state, and they've bankrolled a ballot measure for the November ballot to kill our landmark clean energy law. And it's just a naked attempt to set the clock back on a clean energy future, because these companies are making billions of dollars selling us gasoline. And now we understand that there are some coal special interests that are joining. So, you know, what it comes down to is, can we be passionate as environmentalists, and can we be passionate enough to demand change? Because we are up against powerful interests and a whole lot of money.
I'm glad you brought up AB 32. We could do a whole another segment on that. Maybe we will next time or soon. But among the speakers on this energy panel last night was someone from the California Air Resources Board. He recently stepped down, but he was saying that AB 32, if nothing else, has been a great motivator to force, you know, communities, governments, all of us, companies, to look at how do we, you know, quantify our greenhouse gas emissions and how can we reduce them. So for the very first time, there's not only motivation but regulation that's making people stop and say, how do we measure and, you know, how do we reduce it? So it's really, it provided the impetus to do that, which is the first step. You know, you have to understand what you're dealing with before you understand how to change it. And so AB 32 really is critical. And so you don't think that AB 32 will be harmed by this Lieberman-Kerry bill?
No, without getting too technical, there's the current proposal at the federal level only preempts one action at the state level, and that is the creation of state-based cap-and-trade programs. Because the current proposal, the national level, contemplates actually a national market for reducing pollution. And so it argues that the state cap-and-trade programs would be duplicative. The state cap-and-trade program contemplated for California is less than one-fifth of the targeted reductions of emissions in California. Our plan is to get most of our emissions through things like increased energy standards in buildings, appliance standards, a renewable portfolio requirement for all of our utilities, fuel efficiency standards. And so the Kerry Lieberman proposal actually expressly allows for that continued state leadership. So
okay,
we actually think the current proposal can actually be combined with state and local leadership to move us quicker, move us faster towards, the clean energy future that we need to get to.
And we are moving quickly towards the top of the hour. Wade Crowfoot, thanks for running down that last big question in a short amount of time. Lots of information, but it is an important question. And thanks for your participation. We've been speaking with Wade Crowfoot. He is the West Coast Political Director for the Environmental Defense Fund. That wraps up this show, this version of The Green Front. See you next time. In the meantime, have a great green week.